Walking. My mother pulled on her white tweed coat and shook her shoulders beneath it, letting it settle. She had spent her final years doing hair and makeup for homebound elderly women, going house to house, keeping their beauty rituals alive. She had 3 such appointments today, she said. I followed her, still dazed, out through the garage. Do you want to walk by the lake, Charlie? She said. It's so nice this time of day. I nodded, speechlessly. How much time had passed since I lay in that wet grass, staring at a wreck? How long before someone tracked me down? I could still taste blood in my mouth, and sharp pain came over me in waves. 1 minute I was neutral, the next minute everything ached. But here I was, walking down my old block, carrying my mother's purple vinyl bag of hair supplies. Mom, I finally mumbled, how what, honey? I cleared my throat. How can you be here? I live here, she said. I shook my head. Not anymore, I whispered. She looked up at the sky. You know, the day you were born, the weather was like this. Chilly but nice. It was late afternoon when I went into labor, remember? As if I should answer, oh yeah, I remember. That doctor, what was his name? Raposo? Dr. Raposo. He told me I had to deliver by 6 o'clock because his wife was making his favorite supper and he didn't want to miss it. I had heard this story before. Fish sticks, I mumbled. Fish sticks, she said. Can you imagine? Such an easy thing to make. You'd think if he was rushing so much, it would at least be a steak. Ah, well, I didn't care. He got his fish sticks, she looked at me playfully, and I got you. We took a few more steps. My forehead pounded. I rubbed it with the ball of my hand. What happened, Charlie? She said. Are you in pain? The question was so simple, it was impossible to answer. Pain? Where should I begin? The accident, the leap, the 3-day bender, the wedding, my marriage, the depression, the last 8 years? When was I not in pain? I haven't been so good, Mom, I said. She kept on walking, inspecting the grass. You know, for 3 years after I married your father, I wished for a child. In those days, 3 years to get pregnant, that was a long time. People thought there was something wrong with me. So did I. She exhaled softly. I couldn't imagine a life without children. Once I even... Wait, let's see. She guided me toward the large tree on the corner near our house. This was late one night when I couldn't sleep. She rubbed her hand over the bark as if unearthing an old treasure. Ah, still there. I leaned in. The word please had been carved into the side. Small crooked letters. You had to look carefully, but there it was. Please. You and Roberta weren't the only ones who carved, she said, smiling. What is it? I asked. A prayer. For a child? She nodded. For me? Another nod. On a tree? Trees spend all day looking up at God, she said. I made a face. I know, she lifted her hands in surrender. You're so corny, Mom. She touched the bark again, then made a small hmm sound. She seemed to be considering everything that had happened since the afternoon I came into the world. I wondered how that sound would change if she knew the whole story. So, she said, moving away, now you know how badly someone wanted you, Charlie. Children forget that sometimes. They think of themselves as a burden instead of a wish granted. She straightened and smoothed her coat. I wanted to cry. A wish granted? How long had it been since anyone referred to me as anything close to that? I should have been grateful. I should have been ashamed of how I'd turned my back on my life. Instead, I wanted a drink. I craved the darkness of a bar, the low wattage bulbs, the taste of that numbing alcohol as I watched the glass empty, knowing the sooner it got in me, the sooner it would take me away. I stepped toward her and put my hand on her shoulder. I half expected it to cut right through, like you see in ghost movies. But it didn't. It rested there, and I felt her narrow bones beneath the fabric. You died, I blurted out. A sudden breeze blew leaves off a pile. You make too much of things, she said. Posey Bonetta was a good talker. Everybody said so. But unlike a lot of good talkers, she was also a good listener. She listened to patients down at the hospital. She listened to neighbors in beach chairs on hot summer days. She loved jokes. She would bend over and push a hand into the shoulder of anyone who made her laugh. She was charming. That's how people thought of her. Charming Posy. Apparently, that was only as long as my father's big hands were wrapped around her. Once she was divorced, freed of his grasp, other women didn't want that charm anywhere near their husbands. Thus, my mother lost all of her friends. She might as well have had the plague. The card games she and my father used to play with neighbors? Finished. The invitations to birthday parties? Done. On the 4th of July, you could smell charcoal everywhere, yet no one invited us to their cookout. At Christmas time, you could see cars in front of houses and mingling adults visible through the bay windows, but my mother would be in our kitchen mixing cookie dough. "Aren't you going to that party?" we'd ask. "We're having a party right here," she'd say. She made it seem like her choice, just the three of us. For a long time, I believed New Year's Eve was a family event, meant for squeezing chocolate syrup on ice cream and tooting noisemakers by a TV set. It surprised me to learn that my teenage friends used the night for raiding the family liquor cabinet because their parents were dressed up and gone by 8 o'clock. "You mean you're stuck with your mom on New Year's?" they would ask. "Yeah," I'd moan. But it was my charming mother who was stuck. Times I did not stand up for my mother. I have already given up on Santa Claus by the time my old man leaves, but Roberta is only 6 and she does the whole routine, leaving cookies, writing a note, sneaking to the window, pointing at stars and asking, "Is that a reindeer?" The first December we are on our own, my mother wants to do something special. She finds a complete Santa outfit, the red jacket, red pants, boots, fake beard. On Christmas Eve, she tells Roberta to go to bed at 9:30 and to not, whatever she does, be anywhere near the living room at 10 o'clock, which of course means Roberta is out of bed at 9:55 and watching like a hawk. I follow behind her carrying a flashlight. We sit on the staircase. Suddenly, the room goes dark and we hear rustling. My sister gasps. I flick on my flashlight. Roberta whisper screams, "No, chick!" and I flick it off. But then, being that age, I flick it back on again and catch my mother in her Santa suit with a pillow sack. She turns and tries to bellow, "Ho, ho, ho, who's there?" My sister ducks, but for some reason I keep that light shining on my mother, right in her bearded face, so she has to shield her eyes with her free hand. "Ho, ho," she tries again. Roberta is scrunched up like a bug, peeking over her fists. She whispers, "Chick, shut it off. You'll scare him away." But I can only see the absurdity of the situation, how we are going to have to fake everything from now on. Fake a full dinner table, fake a female Santa Claus, fake being a family instead of three-quarters of a family. "It's just Mom," I say flatly. "Ho, ho, ho," my mother says. "It is not," Roberta says. "Yes, it is, you twerp. It's Mom. Santa Claus isn't a girl, stupid." I keep that light on my mother and I see her posture change. Her head drops back, her shoulders slump, like a fugitive Santa caught by the cops. Roberta starts crying. I can tell my mother wants to yell at me, but she can't do that and blow her cover. So she stares me down between her stocking cap and her cotton beard, and I feel my father's absence all over the room. Finally, she dumps the pillowcase of small presents onto the floor and walks out the front door without so much as another ho, ho, ho. My sister runs back to bed, howling with tears. I am left on the stairs with my flashlight, illuminating an empty room and a tree. Rose. We continued walking through the old neighborhood. By now I had settled into a foggy acceptance of this, what would you call it, temporary insanity. I would go with my mother wherever she wanted to go until whatever I had done caught up with me. To be honest, not all of me wanted it to end. When a lost loved one appears before you, it's your brain that fights it, not your heart. Her first appointment lived in a small brick home in the middle of Lehigh Street, just 2 blocks from our house. There was a metal awning over the porch and a flower box filled with pebbles. The morning air seemed overly crisp now and the light was strange, making the edges of the scenery too sharply defined as if drawn in ink. I still had not seen another person, but it was mid-morning and most folks would be working. Knock, my mother told me. I knocked. She's hard of hearing. Knock louder. I rapped on the door. Knock again. I pounded. Not so hard, she said. Finally, the door opened. An elderly woman wearing a smock and holding a walker pushed her lips into a confused smile. Good morning, Rose, my mother sang. I brought a young man with me. Oh, Rose said. Her voice was so high it was almost bird-like. Yes, I see. You remember my son, Charlie? Oh, yes, I see. She stepped back. Come in, come in. Her house was tidy, small, and seemingly frozen in the 1970s. The carpet was royal blue. The couches were covered in plastic. We followed her to her laundry room. Our steps were unnaturally small and slow, marching behind Rose and her walker. Having a good day, Rose? My mother asked. Oh, yes, now that you're here. Do you remember my son, Charlie? Oh, yes, handsome. She said this with her back to me. And how are your children, Rose? What's that now? Your children. Oh, she waved her palm. They check up on me once a week, like a chore. I couldn't tell, at that point, who or what Rose was. An apparition? A real person? Her house felt real enough. The heat was turned up, and the smell of toasted bread lingered from breakfast. We entered the laundry room where a chair was positioned by the sink. A radio was playing some big band song. Would you turn that off, young man? Rose said, without turning around. The radio. Sometimes I have it too loud. I found the volume knob and clicked it off. Terrible, did you hear? Rose said. An accident by the highway. They were talking about it on the news. I froze. A car hit a truck and crashed through a big sign, knocked it right down. Terrible. I scanned my mother's face, expecting her to turn and demand my confession. Admit what you did, Charlie. Well, Rose, the news is depressing, she said, still unpacking her bag. Oh, yes, Rose said, so much so. Wait, they knew? They didn't know? I had a cold flush of dread, as if someone were about to rap on the windows and demand I come out. Instead, Rose turned her walker, then her knees, then her skinny shoulders in my direction. It's nice that you spend a day with your mother, she said. Children should do it more often. She put a shaky hand on the back of the chair by the sink. Now, Posy, she said, can you still make me beautiful? Maybe you're wondering how my mother came to be a hairdresser. As I mentioned, she had been a nurse, and she truly loved being a nurse. She had that deep well of patience to carefully dress bandages, draw blood, and answer endless worried questions with upbeat reassurances. The male patients liked having someone young and pretty around, and the female patients were grateful when she brushed out their hair or helped them put on lipstick. I doubt it was protocol back then, but my mother applied makeup to more than a few occupants of our county hospital. She believed it made them feel better. That was the point of a hospital stay, wasn't it? You're not supposed to go there and rot, she would say. Sometimes at the dinner table, she would get a faraway look and talk about poor Mrs. Halverson and her emphysema, or poor Roy Endicott and his diabetes. Now and then she would stop talking about a person, and my sister would ask, what did the old lady Galinsky do today? And my mother would answer, she went home, honey. My father would lift his eyebrows and look at her, then go back to chewing his food. It was only when I got older that I realized home meant dead. That was usually when he changed the subject, anyhow. There was only one hospital in our county, and with my father out of the picture, my mother tried to work as many shifts as she could, meaning she couldn't pick up my sister after school. So most days I would fetch Roberta, walk her home, then ride my bike back for baseball practice. Do you think Daddy will be there today? She would ask. No, stupid, I would say. Why should he be there today? Because the grass is high and he has to mow it, she'd say. Or because there are a lot of leaves to rake. Or because it's Thursday and Mommy makes lamb chops on Thursday. I don't think that's a good reason, I'd say. She'd wait before asking the obvious follow-up. Then how come he left, Chick? I don't know. He just did, okay? That's not a good reason either, she'd mumble. One afternoon when I was 12 and she was 7, my sister and I emerged from the schoolyard and heard a honking sound. It's Mommy, Roberta said, running ahead. She didn't get out of the car, which was strange. My mother thought it rude to honk for people. Years later, she would warn my sister that any boy who wouldn't come to the front door was a boy not worth dating. But now here she was, staying in the car, so I followed after my sister and crossed the street and got in. My mother did not look well. Her eyes were black below the lids, and she kept clearing her throat. She was not wearing her nursing whites. "Why are you here?" I asked. That was how I was talking to her in those days. "Give your mother a kiss," she said. I leaned my head across the seat, and she kissed my hair. "Did they let you out of work early?" Roberta asked. "Yes, sweetie, something like that." She sniffed. She looked in the rearview mirror and wiped the black from around her eyes. "How about some ice cream?" she said. "Yeah, yeah," my sister said. "I have practice," I said. "Oh, why don't you skip the practice, okay?" "No," I protested. "You can't skip practice. You have to go." "Says who?" "The coaches and everyone." "I want to go. I want a cone," Roberta said. "Just a fast ice cream," my mother said. "God, no, okay?" I lifted my head and looked straight at her. What I saw, I don't think I had ever seen before. My mother looked lost. I would later learn that she had been fired from the hospital. I would later learn that some staff members felt that she was too much of a distraction to the male doctors now that she was single. I would later learn that there had been some incident with a senior member of the staff, and my mother had complained about inappropriate behavior. Her reward for standing up for herself was the suggestion that it isn't going to work out anymore. And you know the weird thing? Somehow I knew all this the moment I looked her in the eye. Not the details, of course, but lost is lost, and I knew that look because I'd worn it myself. I hated her for having it. I hated her for being as weak as I was. I got out of the car and said, "I don't want any ice cream. I'm going to practice." As I crossed the street, my sister yelled out the window, "Do you want us to bring you a cone?" And I thought, "You're so stupid, Roberta. Cones melt." Times I did not stand up for my mother. She has found my cigarettes. They are in my sock drawer. I am 14 years old. "It's my room," I yell. "Charlie, we talked about this. I told you not to smoke. It's the worst thing you can do. What's the matter with you?" "You're a hypocrite." She stops. Her neck stiffens. "Don't you use that word." "You smoke. You're a hypocrite." "Don't you use that word." "Why not, Mom? You always want me to use big words in a sentence. There's a sentence. You smoke. I can't. My mother is a hypocrite." I am moving as I yell this, and the moving seems to give me strength, confidence, as if she can't hit me. This is after she has taken a job at the beauty parlor, and instead of her nursing whites, she wears fashionable clothes to work, like the petal pushers and turquoise blouse she is wearing now. These clothes show off her figure. I hate them. "I am taking these away," she yells, grabbing the cigarettes. "And you are not going out, mister." "I don't care," I glare at her. "And why do you have to dress like that? You make me sick." "I what?" Now she is on me, slapping my face. "I what? I make you slap. Sick? I make slap. You sick? Slap. Is that what you slap? Said? Slap, slap. Is it? Is that what you think of me?" "No, no," I yell. "Stop it." I cover my head and duck away. I run down the stairs and out the garage. I stay away until well past dark. When I finally come home, her bedroom door is closed and I think I hear her crying. I go to my room. The cigarettes are still there. I light one up and start crying myself. Embarrassed children. Rose had her head tipped back in the sink, and my mother was gently spraying her with water from a faucet attachment. Apparently, they had a whole routine worked out. They propped pillows and towels until Rose's head was just so, and my mother could run her free hand through Rose's wet hair. "Is that warm enough, hon?" my mother said. "Oh, yes, dear, it's fine." Rose closed her eyes. "You know, Charlie, your mother has been doing my hair since I was a much younger woman." "You're young at heart, Rose," my mother said. "That's the only part." They laughed. "When I went to the beauty parlor, I would only ask for Posey. If Posey wasn't there, I would come back the next day. 'Don't you want someone else?' they'd say. But I said, 'Nobody touches me but Posey.' You're sweet, Rose, my mother said. But the other girls were good. Oh, dear, hush, let me brag. Your mother, Charlie, always made time for me. And once it got too hard for me to go to the beauty parlor, she came to my house every week. She tapped her shaky fingers on my mother's forearm. Thank you, dear, for that. You're welcome, Rose. Such a beauty you were, too. I watched my mother smile. How could she be so proud of washing someone's hair in a sink? You should see Charlie's little girl, Rose, my mother said. Talk about a beauty. She's a little heartbreaker. Is that so? What's her name? Maria. Isn't she a heartbreaker, Charlie? How could I answer that? The last time they had seen each other was the day my mother died, 8 years earlier. Maria was still a teenager. How could I tell her what had happened since? That I had fallen out of my daughter's life? That she had a new last name? That I had sunk so low I had been banished from her wedding? She used to love me. She honestly did. She used to run at me when I came home from work, her arms raised, yelling, Daddy, pick me up. What happened? Maria's ashamed of me, I finally mumbled. Don't be silly, my mother said. You don't understand. She looked over at me and rubbed shampoo between her palms. I lowered my head. I wanted a drink in the worst way. I could feel her eyes. I could hear her fingers kneading Rose's hair. Of all the things I felt disgraced about in front of my mother, being a lousy father was the worst. You know something, Rose? She suddenly said. Charlie never let me cut his hair. Can you believe that? He insisted on going to a barber shop. Why, dear? Oh, you know, they get to an age and it's, get away, Mom, get away. Children get embarrassed by their parents. Children get embarrassed by their parents, my mother repeated. It was true. As a teenager, I had pushed my mother away. I refused to sit next to her at movies. I squirmed from her kisses. I was uncomfortable with her womanly figure, and I was angry that she was the only divorced woman around. I wanted her to behave like the other mothers, wearing house dresses, making scrapbooks, baking brownies. Sometimes your kids will say the nastiest things, won't they, Rose? You want to ask, whose child is this? Rose chuckled. But usually they're just in some kind of pain. They need to work it out. She shot me a look. Remember, Charlie, sometimes kids want you to hurt the way they hurt. To hurt the way they hurt. Was that what I had done? Had I wanted to see on my mother's face the rejection I felt from my father? Had my daughter done the same to me? I didn't mean anything by it, Mom, I whispered. By what? Being embarrassed by you or your clothes or your situation. She rinsed the shampoo from her hand, then directed the water to Rose's scalp. A child embarrassed by his mother, she said, is just a child who hasn't lived long enough. There was a cuckoo clock in the den, and it broke the silence with small chimes and a mechanical sliding noise. My mother was trimming Rose's hair now with a comb and scissors. The phone rang. Charlie, dear, Rose said, could you get that for me? I walked into the next room following the ring until I saw a phone hanging on the wall outside the kitchen. Hello, I said into the receiver. And everything changed. Charles Bonetto! It was a man's voice screaming. Charles Bonetto, can you hear me, Charles? I froze. Charles, I know you can hear me. Charles, there's been an accident. Talk to us. Hands shaking, I placed the phone back in the cradle. Times my mother stood up for me. It is 3 years after my father's departure. In the middle of the night, I awaken to the sound of my sister thumping down the hall. She is always running to my mother's bedroom. I bury my head in the pillow, drifting back to sleep. Charlie! My mother is suddenly in the room, whispering loudly. Charlie, where's your baseball bat? What? I groan, rising to my elbows. Shh! My sister says. A bat, my mother says. Why do you need a bat? Shh! My sister says. She heard something. A robber's in the house? Shh! My sister says. My heart races. As kids, we have heard of cat burglars, although we think they steal cats, and we have heard of thieves who break into houses and tie up the residents. I immediately imagine something worse, an intruder whose sole purpose is to kill us all. Charlie, the bat! I point to the closet. My chest is heaving. She finds my black Louisville slugger, and my sister lets go of her hand and jumps into my bed. I am pushing my palms into the mattress, not sure what role I should play. My mother eases out the door. Stay here, she whispers. I want to tell her that her grip is wrong, but she's gone. My sister is trembling next to me. I'm ashamed to be lumped in with her, so I slide out from the bed to the doorframe, despite her pulling at my pajama bottoms so hard they nearly rip. In the hallway, I hear every creak of the house settling, and in each one I imagine a thief with a knife. I hear what seems to be a soft thudding. I hear footsteps. I imagine a big ruddy beast of a man coming up the stairs from my sister and me. Then I hear something real, a smash. Then I hear voices. Is it voices? Yes, no, wait. That's my mother's voice, right? I want to run downstairs. I want to run back to bed. I hear something deeper. Is it another voice? A man's voice? I swallow. Moments later, I hear a door close, hard. Then I hear footsteps approaching. My mother's voice precedes her. It's all right, she's saying, no longer whispering. And she moves quickly into the room and rubs my head as she passes me to get to my sister. She drops the bat and it clunks on the floor. My sister is crying. It's all right, it was nothing, my mother says. I slump against the wall. My mother hugs my sister. She exhales longer than I have heard anyone exhale before. Who was it, I ask. Nothing, nobody, she says. But I know she is lying. I know who it was. Come here, Charlie. She holds a hand out. I straggle over, my arms at my side. She pulls me in, but I resist. I am angry with her. I will remain angry with her until the day I leave this house for good. I know who it was, and I am angry that she wouldn't let my father stay. All right, Rose, my mother was saying as I re-entered the room. You're going to look beautiful. Just give it a half hour. Who was on the phone, dear? Rose asked me. I could barely shake my head. My fingers were trembling. Charlie, my mother asked, are you all right? It wasn't, I swallowed. There was no one there. Maybe it was a salesman, Rose said. They're afraid when men answer the phone. They like old ladies like me. I sat down. I felt suddenly spent, too tired to keep my chin up. What had just happened? Whose voice was that? How did someone know where to find me, yet not come get me? The harder I tried to think, the dizzier I got. Are you tired, Charlie? My mother asked. Just give me a second, I said. My eyes drooped shut. Sleep, I heard a voice say, but I couldn't tell which of them said it. That's how gone I was. Times my mother stood up for me. I am 15, and for the first time, I need to shave. There are stray hairs on my chin and straggly hairs above my lip. My mother calls me to the bathroom one night after Roberta is asleep. She has purchased a Gillette safety razor, two stainless steel blades, and a tube of BermaShave cream. Do you know how to do this? She asks. Of course, I say. I have no idea how to do it. Go ahead, she says. I squeeze the cream from the tube. I dab it on my face. You rub it in, she says. I rub it in. I keep going until my cheeks and chin are covered. I take the razor. Be careful, she says. Pull in one direction, not up and down. I know, I say, annoyed. I am uncomfortable doing this in front of my mother. It should be my father. She knows it. I know it. Neither one of us says it. I follow her instructions. I pull in one direction, watching the cream scrape away in a broad line. When I pull the blade over my chin, it sticks and I feel a cut. Ooh, Charlie, are you all right? She reaches for me, then pulls her hands back, as if she knows she shouldn't. Stop worrying, I say, determined to keep going. She watches. I continue. I pull down around my jaw and my neck. When I am finished, I look at her. She puts her cheek in one hand and smiles. She whispers in a British accent, By George, you've got it. That makes me feel good. Now wash your face, she says. Times I did not stand up for my mother. It is Halloween. I am 16 now, too old to go trick-or-treating, but my sister wants me to take her out after supper. She's convinced you get better candy when it's dark. So I reluctantly agree, as long as my new girlfriend, Joni, can come with us. Joni is a sophomore cheerleader, and I am, by this point, a star on the varsity baseball team. Let's go far away and get all new candy, my sister says. It is cold outside, and we dig our hands into our pockets as we walk from house to house. Roberta collects her candy in a brown paper shopping bag. I wear my baseball jacket. Joni wears her cheerleading sweater. Trick or treat, my sister squeals when a door opens. Oh, and who are you, dear? The woman says. She's about my mother's age, I guess, but she has red hair and is wearing a house dress and has badly drawn eyebrows. I'm a pirate, Roberta says. Grrr! The woman smiles and drops a chocolate bar in my sister's bag, as if dropping a penny in a bank. It goes plunk. I'm her brother, I say. I'm with them, Joni says. And do I know your parents? She is about to drop another bar in my sister's bag. My mom is Mrs. Bonetto, Roberta says. The woman halts. She pulls the candy back. Don't you mean Miss Bonetto? She says. None of us know what to say. The woman's expression has changed, and those drawn eyebrows are straining downward. Now you listen to me, sweetie. Tell your mother that my husband doesn't need to see her little fashion show by his shop every day. Tell her not to get any grand ideas, you hear me? No grand ideas. Joni looks at me. The back of my neck is burning. Can I have that one too? Roberta asks, her eyes on the chocolate. The woman pulls it closer to her chest. Come on, Roberta, I mumble, yanking her away. Must run in the family, the woman says. You all want your hands on everything. You tell her what I said. No grand ideas, you hear me? We are already halfway across her lawn. Rose says goodbye. When we stepped out of Rose's house, the sun was brighter than before. Rose followed us as far as the porch, where she remained, the aluminum door frame resting against the side of her walker. Well, so long, Rose, honey, my mother said. Thank you, dear, she said. I'll see you soon. Of course you will. My mother kissed her on the cheek. I had to admit she had done a nice job. Rose's hair was shaped and styled, and she looked years younger than when we'd arrived. You look nice, I said. Thank you, Charlie. It's a special occasion. She readjusted her grip on the walker handles. What's the occasion? I'm going to see my husband. I didn't want to ask where, in case, you know, he was in a home or a hospital. So I blurted out, oh yeah, that's nice. Yes, she said softly. My mother pulled at a stray thread on her coat. Then she looked at me and smiled. Rose moved backward, allowing the door to close. We stepped down carefully, my mother holding my arm. When we reached the sidewalk, she motioned to the left and we turned. The sun was nearly straight above us now. How about some lunch, Charlie? She said. I almost laughed. What? My mother said. Nothing, sure, lunch. It made as much sense as anything else. You feel better now, with a little nap? I shrugged. I guess. She tapped my hand affectionately. She's dying, you know.
Who, Rose?
Mm-hmm. I don't get it. She seemed fine. She squinted up at the sun. She'll die tonight.
Tonight?
Yes. But she said she's going to see her husband. She is. I stopped walking. Mom, I said, how do you know that? She smiled. I'm helping her get ready.
Part 3. Noon. Chick and college. I would guess the day I went to college was one of the happiest of my mother's life. At least it started out that way. The university had offered to pay half my tuition with a baseball scholarship, although when my mother told her friends, she just said, scholarship, her love of that word eclipsing any possibility that I was admitted to hit the ball, not the books. I remember the day we drove up for my freshman year. She'd been awake before sunrise, and there was a full breakfast waiting for me when I stumbled down the stairs. Pancakes, bacon, eggs. 6 people couldn't have finished that much food. Roberta had wanted to come with us, but I said no way. What I meant was it was bad enough that I had to go with my mother. So she consoled herself with a plateful of syrup-covered French toast. We dropped her at a neighbor's house and began our 4-hour trek. Because to my mother this was a big occasion, she wore one of her outfits, a purple pantsuit, a scarf, high heels, and sunglasses, and she insisted that I wear a white shirt and a necktie. "You're starting college, not going fishing," she said. Together we would have stood out badly enough in Pepperville Beach, but remember, this was college in the mid-60s, where the less correctly you were dressed, the more you were dressed correctly. So when we finally got to campus and stepped out of our Chevy station wagon, we were surrounded by young women in sandals and peasant skirts and young men in tank tops and shorts, their hair worn long over their ears. And there we were, a necktie and a purple pantsuit, and I felt once more that my mother was shining a ridiculous light on me. She wanted to know where the library was, and she found someone to give us directions. "Charlie, look at all the books," she marveled as we walked around the ground floor. "You could stay in here all 4 years and never make a dent." Everywhere she went, she kept pointing. "Look, that cubicle, you could study there. And look, that cafeteria table, you could eat there." I tolerated it because I knew she would be leaving soon. But as we walked across the lawn, a good-looking girl, gum-chewing, white lipstick, bangs on her forehead, caught my eye and I caught hers, and I flexed my arm muscles and I thought, my first college girl, who knows? And at that very moment, my mother said, "Did we pack your toiletry kit?" How do you answer that? A yes, a no, a Jesus, Mom. It's all bad. The girl continued past us, and she sort of guffawed, or maybe I just imagined that. Anyhow, we didn't exist in her universe. I watched her sashay over to 2 bearded guys sprawled under a tree. She kissed one on the lips, and she fell in alongside them, and here I was with my mother, asking about my toiletry kit. An hour later, I hoisted my trunk to the stairwell of my dorm. My mother was carrying my 2 lucky baseball bats with which I had led the Pepperville County Conference in home runs. "Here," I said, holding out my hand. "I'll take the bats." "I'll go up with you." "No, it's all right." "But I want to see your room." "Mom." "What?" "Come on." "What?" "You know, come on." I couldn't think of anything else that wouldn't hurt her feelings, so I just pushed my hand out farther. Her face sank. I was 6 inches taller than her now. She handed me the bats. I balanced them atop the trunk. "Charlie," she said. Her voice was softer now, and it sounded different. "Give your mother a kiss." I put the trunk down with a small thud. I leaned toward her. Just then, 2 older students came bounding down the stairs, feet thumping, voices loud and laughing. I instinctively jerked away from my mother. "Excuse, please," one of them said as they maneuvered around us. Once they were gone, I leaned forward, only intending a peck on the cheek, but she threw her arms around my neck and she drew me close. I could smell her perfume, her hairspray, her skin moisturizer, all the assorted potions and lotions she had doused herself in for this special day. I pulled away, lifted the trunk, and began my climb, leaving my mother in the stairwell of a dormitory, as close as she would ever get to a college education. The middle of the day. "So how is Catherine?" We were back in her kitchen having lunch, as she had suggested. Since I'd been on my own, I had eaten most of my meals from bar stools or in fast food outlets. But my mother had always shunned eating away from home. "Why should we pay for bad food?" she would say. After my father left, it became a moot point. We ate at home because we couldn't afford to eat out anymore. "Charlie, honey," she repeated, "how's Catherine?" "She's okay," I lied, not having any idea how Catherine was. "And this business about Maria being ashamed of you, what does Catherine say about that?" She carried over a plate with a sandwich, pumpernickel bread, roast beef, tomato, and mustard. She sliced it diagonally. I can't remember the last time I saw a sandwich sliced diagonally. "Mom," I said, "to be honest, Catherine and I split up." She finished slicing. She seemed to be thinking about something. "Did you hear what I said, Mom?"
"Hmm,"
she answered quietly without looking up. "Yes, Charlie, I did."
"It wasn't her, it was me. I haven't been real good for a while, you know. That's why..."
What was I going to say? "That's why I tried to kill myself?" She pushed the plate in front of me.
"Mom,"
my voice cracked,
"we buried you. You've been gone a long time."
I stared at the sandwich, two triangles of bread.
"Everything's different now," I whispered.
She reached over and put my cheek in her hand. She grimaced as if a pain were passing through her.
"Things can be fixed," she said.
A note dated September 8th, 1967. Charlie, how do you like my typing? I've been practicing at work on Henrietta's typewriter. Pretty snazzy. I know you won't read this until after I have left, but in case I forgot because I was too excited by the whole idea of you being at college, I want to tell you something. I am so proud of you, Charlie. You are the first person in our family to go to a university. Charlie, be nice to the people there. Be nice to your teachers. Always call them Mr. and Mrs., even though I hear now that college students call their teachers by their first names. I don't think that's right. And be nice to the girls you go out with. I know you don't want love life advice from me, but even if girls find you handsome, that is not a license to be mean. Be nice. And also, get your sleep. Josie, who comes into the beauty parlor, says her son at college keeps falling asleep during his classes. Don't insult your teachers that way, Charlie. Don't fall asleep. It's such a lucky thing you have, to be taught and to be learning and not have to be working in a shop somewhere. I love you every day. Now I will miss you every day. Love, Mom. When Ghosts Return. I used to dream about finding my father. I imagined he moved to the next town over, and one day I would ride my bike to his house and knock on his door, and he would tell me it was all just a big mistake. And the two of us would ride home together, me on the front, my dad pedaling hard behind, and my mother would run out the door and burst into happy tears. It's amazing the fantasies your mind can put together. The truth was, I didn't know where my father lived, and I never did find out. I would go by his liquor store after school, but he was never there. His friend Marty was managing it now, and he told me my dad was full-time in the new place in Collingswood. It was only an hour's drive away, but to a kid my age, it might as well have been on the moon. After a while, I stopped going past his store. I stopped fantasizing about us biking home together. I finished grade school, junior high, and high school with no contact from my old man. He was a ghost, but I still saw him. I saw him whenever I swung a bat or threw a ball, which is why I never gave up baseball, why I played through every spring and every summer on every team and in every league possible. I could picture my father at the plate, tipping my elbow, correcting my batting stance. I could hear him yelling, "Dig, dig, dig," as I ran out a ground ball. A boy can always see his father on a baseball field. In my mind, it was just a matter of time before he showed up for real. So, year after year, I pulled on new team uniforms, red socks, gray pants, blue tops, yellow caps, and each one felt like I was dressing for a visit. I split my adolescence between the pulpy smell of books, which was my mother's passion, and the leathery smell of baseball gloves, which was my father's. My body sprouted into his frame, broad and strong-shouldered, but 2 inches taller. And as I grew, I held on to the game, like a raft in the bumpy sea, faithfully, through the chop, until at last it restored me to my father, as I always knew it would. He reappeared after an 8-year absence at my first college game in the spring of 1968, sitting in the front row of seats just left of home plate, from which he could best study my form. I will never forget that day. It was a windy afternoon, and the sky was a gunmetal color, threatening rain. I walked to the plate. I don't usually look at the seats, but for whatever reason I did, and there he was. His hair was graying at the temples, and his shoulders seemed smaller, his waist a bit wider, as if he had sunk down on himself. But otherwise, he looked the same.
If he was uncomfortable, he didn't show it. I'm not sure I'd recognize my father's uncomfortable look anyhow. He nodded at me. Everything seemed to freeze. 8 years. 8 whole years. I felt my lip tremble. I remember a voice in my head saying, "Don't you dare, chick. Don't you cry, you bastard. Don't cry." I looked at my feet. I forced them to move. I kept my eyes on them all the way into the batter's box. And I smacked the first pitch over the left field wall. Miss Thelma. My mother's next appointment, she said, was with someone who lived in a part of town we called the Flats. It was mostly poor people in attached row houses. I was sure we'd need to drive there, but before I could ask, the doorbell rang. "Answer that, Charlie, okay?" my mother said, putting a dish in the sink. I hesitated. I didn't want to answer any bells or pick up any phones. When my mother called out again, "Charlie, can you get that?" I rose and walked slowly to the door. I told myself everything was fine, but the instant I touched the knob, I felt a sudden blast that blinded me, a wash of light, and a man's voice, the voice from Rose's telephone. It was screaming now. "Charles Bonetto, listen, I'm a police officer." It felt like a windstorm. The voice was so close I could physically touch it. "Can you hear me, Charles? I'm a police officer." I staggered back and threw my hands over my face. The light disappeared. The wind died. I heard only my own labored breathing. I quickly looked for my mother, but she was still at the sink. Whatever I was going through was happening in my head. I waited a few seconds, inhaled 3 long breaths, and carefully turned the doorknob, eyes lowered, expecting the police officer who'd been screaming at me. I pictured him young for some reason. But when I lifted my gaze, I saw instead an elderly black woman with spectacles on a chain around her neck, disheveled hair, and a burning cigarette. "Is that you, Chickadoo?" she said. "Well, look who done grown up." We called her Miss Thelma. She used to clean our house. She was lean and narrow-shouldered, with a broad smile and a quick temper. Her hair was dyed a reddish-orange, and she smoked constantly, Lucky Strikes, which she kept in her shirt pocket like a man. Born and raised in Alabama, she somehow wound up in Pepperville Beach, where in the late 1950s, pretty much every house on our side of town employed someone like her. A domestic, they were called, or, when people were being honest, a maid. My father would pick her up Saturday mornings at the bus station near the Horn and Hardart cafeteria, and he would pay her before he left the house, slipping her the folded bills low by her hip, as if neither were supposed to look at the money. She would clean all day while we were out at baseball. By the time we got home, my room was spotless, whether I liked it or not. My mother insisted we call her Miss Thelma. I remember that, and I remember we weren't allowed to step into any room she had just vacuumed. I remember she played catch with me sometimes in the backyard, and she could throw as hard as I could. She also, inadvertently, invented my nickname. My father had tried calling me Chuck. My mother hated that. She said, "Chuck, it sounds like a cowhand." But because I was always hollering from the backyard into the house, "Mom," or "Roberta," one day Miss Thelma looked up annoyed and said, "Boy, the way you holler, you're like a rooster. Chuck-a-doodle-doo." And my sister, who was then a preschooler, said, "Chick-a-doodle-doo, chick-a-doodle-doo." And I don't know, somehow the chick part stuck. I don't think that made my dad too fond of Miss Thelma. "Posey," she said to my mother now, her grin spreading, "I've been thinking about you." "Well, thank you," my mother said. "I surely have." She turned to me. "Can't throw you no balls these days, Chickadoo," she laughed. "Too old." We were in her car, which I guessed was how we were getting to the Flats. It seemed odd to me that my mother would do beauty work for Miss Thelma, but then I knew so little about my mother over the last decade of her life. I had been too wrapped up in my own drama. As we drove, for the first time, I saw other people out the window. There was a pinched old man with a gray beard carrying a rake to his garage. My mother waved to him, and he waved back. There was a woman with hair the color of French vanilla ice cream, wearing a house dress and sitting on her porch. Another wave from my mother, another wave back. We drove for a while until the streets became smaller and rougher. We turned on a gravel road and came to a 2-family house with a roofed porch flanked by cellar doors, badly in need of paint. There were several cars parked in the driveway. A bicycle lay on its side in the front yard. Miss Thelma put the car in park and turned the key. And just like that, we were inside the house. The bedroom was paneled with olive carpeting. The bed itself was an old four-poster. And Miss Thelma was suddenly lying in it, propped up against two pillows. "What just happened?" I asked my mother. She shook her head as if to say, "Not now," and began unpacking her bag. I heard children squealing from another room and the muffled sounds of a television set and plates being moved around the table.
"They all think I'm sleeping," Miss Thelma whispered.
She looked my mother in the eye.
"Posey, I sure would appreciate it now. Could you?"
"Of course," my mother replied.
Times I did not stand up for my mother. I don't tell her about seeing my father. He shows up for my next game, too, and he nods again when I come to the plate. This time I nod back, barely, but I do, and I go 3 for 3 in that game, with another home run and 2 doubles. We go on like this for several weeks. He sits, he watches, and I hit the ball like it's 2 feet wide. Finally, after a road game in which I hit 2 more home runs, he is waiting by the team bus. He wears a blue windbreaker over a white turtleneck. I notice the gray in his sideburns. He lifts his chin when he sees me, as if fighting the fact that I am now taller than him. These are the first words he says. "Ask your coach if I can drive you back to campus." I could do anything at this moment. I could spit. I could tell him to go to hell. I could ignore him the way he ignored us. I could say something about my mother. Instead, I do what he asks me to do. I seek permission to skip the bus ride home. He is respecting the authority of my coach. I am respecting the authority of my father. And this is how the world makes sense, all of us behaving like men.
"I don't know, Posey," Miss Thelma said. "It's going to take a miracle."
She was looking into a handheld mirror. My mother unloaded small jars and jeweled cases.
"Well, this is my miracle bag," she said.
"Yeah? Y'all got a cure for cancer in there?"
My mother held up a bottle.
"I've got moisturizer."
Miss Thelma laughed.
"You think it's silly, Posey?"
"What's that, honey?"
"Wanting to look good at this point."
"There's nothing wrong with it, if that's what you mean."
"Well, you see, my boys and girls are out there, that's all. And they're little ones. I wish I could look healthy for them, you know? I don't like to make them fret, see me like some old dish rag."
My mother rubbed moisturizer on Miss Thelma's face, making wide circular motions with her palms.
"You could never look like a dish rag," she said.
"Oh, talk to me, Posey."
They laughed again.
"I miss them Saturdays sometimes," Miss Thelma said. "We had some fun, didn't we?"
"We did it that," my mother said.
"We did it that," Miss Thelma agreed.
She closed her eyes as my mother's hands did their work.
"Chickadoo, your mama's the best partner I ever had."
I wasn't sure what she meant.
"You worked at the beauty parlor," I said.
My mother grinned.
"Nah," Miss Thelma said. "I couldn't make nobody look better if I tried."
My mother capped the moisturizer bottle and picked up a new jar. She undid the top and dabbed a small sponge into its contents.
"What?" I said. I don't get it."
She held up the sponge like an artist about to put brush to canvas.
"We cleaned houses together, Charlie," she said.
Upon seeing the look on my face, she waved her fingers dismissively.
"How do you think I put you kids through college?"
By my sophomore year, I'd packed on 10 pounds of muscle, and my hitting reflected it. My batting average amongst college players was in the top 50 in the nation. At my father's urging, I played in several tournaments, which were showcases for professional scouts, older men who sat in the stands with notebooks and cigars. One day, one of them approached us after a game.
"Is your boy?"
he asked my father. My father nodded suspiciously. The man had thinning hair and a bulbous nose, and his undershirt was visible through his lightweight sweater.
"I'm with the St. Louis Cardinals organization."
"That right," my father said.
I wanted to leap through my skin. "We may have a spot at catcher, A-ball."
"That right," my father said.
"We'll keep an eye on your boy if he's interested."
The man sniffed deeply, a wet, noisy sound. He took out a handkerchief and blew his nose.
"The thing is," my father said, "Pittsburgh has the inside track. They've been scouting him for a while."
The man studied my father's jaw, which worked over the gum he was chewing.
"That right," the man said. Of course, all this was news to me, and when the man departed, I hounded my father with questions. When did this happen? Was that guy for real? Was Pittsburgh really scouting me? What if they are? My father said. It don't change what you got to do, Chick. You stay in those cages, work with your coaches, and be ready when the time comes. Let me take care of the rest. I nodded obediently. My mind was racing. What about school? He scratched his chin. What about it? I flashed on my mother's face, walking me through the library. I tried not to think about it. The St. Louis Cardinals, my father drawled, long and slow. He ground his shoe into the grass. Then he actually grinned. I felt so proud I got goosebumps. He asked if I wanted a beer, and I said yeah, and we went and had one together, as men do. Dad came to a game. I was on the payphone in the dorm. This was well after my father's first visit, but it had taken me that long to find the courage to tell my mother. Oh, she finally said. By himself, I quickly added. For some reason, that seemed important. Did you tell your sister? No. Another long silence. Don't let anything affect your studying, Charlie. I won't. That's the most important thing. I know. An education is everything, Charlie. An education is how you'll make something of yourself. I kept waiting for more. I kept waiting for some horrible story about some horrible thing. I kept waiting the way all children of divorce wait, for evidence to tip my scales, a tilt in the floor that made me choose one side over the other. But my mother never spoke about the reason my father left. She never once took the bait Roberta and I dangled before her, looking for hate or bitterness. All she did was swallow. She swallowed the words. She swallowed the conversation. Whatever had happened between them, she swallowed that too. Is it okay that me and Dad see each other? Dad and I, she corrected. Dad and I said exasperated. Is it? She exhaled. You're not a little boy anymore, Charlie. Why did I feel like one? Looking back on that now, there's so much I didn't know. I didn't know how she really took that news. I didn't know if it angered her or scared her. I certainly didn't know that while I was having beers with my father, the bills back home were being paid, in part, by my mother cleaning houses with a woman who once cleaned ours. I watched the two of them now in the bedroom, Miss Thelma upright against the pillows, my mother working her makeup sponges and her eyeliner pencils. Why didn't you tell me? I asked. Tell you what, my mother said. That you had to, you know, for money. Mop floors, do laundry. My mother chuckled. I don't know. Maybe because of the way you're looking at me now. She sighed. You were always proud, Charlie. I was not, I snapped. She lifted her eyebrows, then returned to Miss Thelma's face. Under her breath, she mumbled, If you say so. Don't do that, I said. Do what? If you say so, that. I didn't say anything, Charlie. Yes, you did. Don't yell. I wasn't proud just because I... My voice cracked. What was I doing? I lowered my gaze. A half day with my dead mother, and we were back to arguing? Ain't no shame in needing work, Chickadoo, Miss Thelma said. My mother touched her hand. Miss Thelma was one of the few people who actually tried to help me. Thank goodness we stayed friends. I had never thought of them as friends. The last time I had seen Miss Thelma was shortly after my father had left. I came home from school one day, and she was sitting next to my mother in the kitchen having coffee. They stopped talking when I entered. After that, we didn't see her anymore. Like I said, ain't no shame in needing work, Miss Thelma repeated. But the only work I knew was what I'd been doing. And your mom said, well, what about that? I said, Posey, you want to be somebody's cleaning woman? And she said, Thelma, if you ain't above cleaning the house, why should I be? Remember that, Posey? My mother inhaled. I didn't say ain't. Miss Thelma howled with laughter. No, that's right. You didn't. I'm sure of that. You didn't say ain't. They were both laughing now. My mother was trying to work under Miss Thelma's eyes. Hold still, she said, but they kept on laughing. I think Mom should get married again, Roberta said. This was one time when I called home from college. What are you talking about? She's still pretty, but nobody stays pretty forever. She's not as thin as she used to be. She doesn't want to get married. How do you know? She doesn't need to get married, Roberta, okay?
If she doesn't get somebody soon, nobody is going to want her.
Stop it. She wears a girdle now, Charlie. I saw it.
I don't care, Roberta. God!
You think you're so cool because you go to college.
Cut it out.
Did you ever hear that song, Yummy, Yummy, Yummy? I think it's so stupid. How come they play it all the time?
Is she talking to you about getting married?
Maybe.
Roberta, I'm not kidding. What did she say?
Nothing, okay? But who knows where the hell Dad is, and Mom shouldn't have to be by herself all the time.
Stop cursing, I said.
I can say whatever I want, Charlie. You're not my boss.
She was 15. I was 20. She had no idea about my father. I had seen him and talked to him. She wanted my mother happy. I wanted her to stay the same. It had been 9 years since that Saturday morning when my mother crushed the corn puffs in the palm of her hand. 9 years since we'd all been a family. In college, I had a course in Latin, and one day the word divorce came up. I always figured it came from some root that meant divide. In truth, it comes from divertere, which means to divert. I believe that. All divorce does is divert you, taking you away from everything you thought you knew and everything you thought you wanted, and steering you into all kinds of other stuff, like discussions about your mother's girdle and whether she should marry someone else. Chick makes his choice. There are 2 days at college that I'll share with you here because they were the high and low points of that experience. The high came in my second year sometime during the fall semester. Baseball hadn't started up, so I actually had time to hang out on campus. On a Thursday night after midterm exams, one of the fraternities had a big party. It was crowded and dark. Music blasted. Black lights made the posters on the walls, and everyone at the party seemed phosphorescent. We laughed loudly and toasted each other with plastic cups of beer. At some point, a guy with long, stringy hair jumped on a chair and began lip-syncing to the music and playing air guitar. It was a song by the Jefferson Airplane, and it quickly became a contest. We went flipping through the milk crates of albums to find a performance song. Well, I don't know who owned these albums, but I spotted an unlikely one, and I yelled to my buddies, "Hey, wait, look at this!" It was the Bobby Darin album my mother used to play when we were kids. He wore a white tuxedo on the cover, his hair embarrassingly short and neat. "I know this one," I said. "I know all the words." "Get out," one buddy said. "Put it on," another said. "Look at that doofus." We commandeered the turntable, lined up the needle to the groove of "This Could Be the Start of Something Big," and when the music began, everybody froze because this clearly wasn't rock and roll. Suddenly, I was out there with my two pals. They looked at each other, embarrassed, and pointed at me as they shook their hips. But I was feeling loose, and I figured, who cares? So as the trumpets and clarinets boomed over the speakers, I mouthed the words that I knew by heart. I was snapping my fingers like the crooners from the Steve Allen Show, and suddenly everyone was laughing and hollering, "Yeah, go, Cat!" I got more and more ridiculous. I guess no one could believe I knew all the words to such a hokey record. Anyhow, by the time it was done, I got a big ovation, and my friends tackled me around the waist, and we pushed into one another, laughing and calling each other names. I met Catherine that night. This is what makes it the high point. She had watched my performance with a few of her girlfriends. I caught sight of her, and I shivered, even as I was flapping my arms and lip-syncing. She wore a sleeveless pink cotton blouse, hip-hugger jeans, and strawberry-colored lip gloss, and she playfully snapped her fingers as I sang Bobby Darin. To this day, I don't know if she would have given me a second look had I not been making such an utter fool of myself. "Where did you learn that song?" she said, stepping up as I drew a beer from the keg. My mom," I answered. I felt like an idiot. Who begins a conversation with "my mom"?
But she seemed to like the idea, and, well, we went from there. The next day I got my grades, and they were good, 2 A's, 2 B's. I called my mother at the beauty parlor, and she came to the phone. I told her the results, and I told her about Catherine and the Bobby Darin song, and she seemed so happy that I had called her in the middle of the day. Over the rumble of hair dryers, she yelled, "Charlie, I'm so proud of you." That was the high point. I dropped out of college 1 year later. That was the low point. I dropped out to play minor league baseball, at my father's suggestion and to my mother's everlasting disappointment. I had been offered a spot in the Pittsburgh Pirates organization to play winter ball and hopefully make their minor league roster. My father felt this was the right time. "You can't get any better playing against college kids," he said. When I first mentioned the idea to my mother, she screamed, "Absolutely not!" It didn't matter that baseball would pay me. It didn't matter that the scouts thought I had potential, maybe enough to make it to the major leagues. "Absolutely not," were her words, and I absolutely ignored her. I went to the registrar's office, told them I was leaving, packed up a duffel bag, and split. Many guys my age were being sent to Vietnam, but by whatever twist of luck or fate, I had drawn a low number in the draft lottery. My father, a veteran, seemed relieved at that fact. "You don't need the trouble you get into during a war," he said. Instead, I marched to his cadence, and I followed his command. I joined a minor league club in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and my student days were over. What can I say about that? Was I seduced by baseball or my father's approval? Both, I suppose. It felt natural, like I was back on the trail of breadcrumbs I had followed as a schoolboy, before things flopped over, before my life as a mama's boy had begun. I remember calling her from the motel phone in San Juan. I had flown there straight from college, the first time I'd ever been on an airplane. I didn't want to stop at home because I knew she would make a scene. "A collect call from your son," the operator said with a Spanish accent. When my mother realized where I was, that the deal was done, she seemed stunned. Her voice was flat. She asked what kind of clothes I had, what was I doing for food. She seemed to be reading from a list of required questions. "Is it safe, the place you're staying?" she said. "Safe? I guess," I said. "Who else do you know there?" "Nobody, but there's guys on the team. I have a roommate. He's from Indiana or Iowa or someplace." "Mm-hmm." Then silence. "Mom, I can always go back to school." This time the silence was longer. She said only one more thing before we hung up. "Going back to something is harder than you think, Charlie." I don't suppose I could have broken my mother's heart anymore if I tried. The work you have to do. Miss Thelma closed her eyes and leaned her head back. My mother resumed her makeup process. She dabbed the sponge around her former partner's face, and I watched with mixed emotions. "I always thought it was so important what came after your name, Chick Bonetto, professional baseball player, not Chick Bonetto, salesman. Now I learned that after Posey Bonetto, nurse, and Posey Bonetto, beautician, it was Posey Bonetto, cleaning woman." It angered me that she had dropped so low. "Mom," I said haltingly, "why didn't you just get money from Dad?" My mother set her face firmly. "I didn't need any more from your father." "Mm-hmm," Miss Thelma added. "We got by all right, Charlie." "Mm-hmm, you did." "Why didn't you go back to the hospital?" I said. "They didn't want me. Why didn't you fight it?" "Would that have made you happy?" she sighed. "It wasn't like today, where people sue over the slightest thing. It was the only hospital around. We couldn't just leave town. This was our home. You and your sister had endured enough change. It's all right. I found work." "Cleaning houses," I mumbled. She put her hands down. "I'm not as ashamed of that as you are," she said. "But," I stumbled for words, you couldn't do the work that mattered to you." My mother looked at me with a glint of defiance. "I did what mattered to me," she said. "I was a mother." We were silent after that. Finally, Miss Thelma opened her eyes. "So what about you, Chickadoo?" she said. "You ain't still up there on that big stage playing baseball?" I shook my head. "No, I suppose not," she said. "Young man's business, baseball is. But you'll always be that little boy to me, with that glove on your hand, so serious and all." "Charlie has a family now," my mother said. "Is that right?" "And a good job. There you go." Miss Thelma eased her head back. "You're doing awfully fine then, Chickadoo, awfully fine." They were all wrong. I wasn't doing fine. "I hate my job," I said. "Well," Miss Thelma shrugged, "sometimes that happens. Can't be much worse than scrubbing your bathtub, can it?" She grinned. "You do what you gotta do to hold your family together. Ain't that right, Posey?" I watched them finish their routine. Two old women, two old friends. I thought about how many years Miss Thelma must have run vacuums or scrubbed tubs to feed her kids, how many shampoos or dye jobs my mother must have done to feed us. And me, I got to play a game for 10 years, and I wanted 20. I felt suddenly ashamed.
What's wrong with that job you got anyhow? Miss Thelma said. I pictured the sales office, the steel desks, the dim fluorescent lights.
I didn't want to be ordinary, I mumbled.
My mother looked up. What's ordinary, Charlie?
You know, I said, someone you forget.
From the other room came the squeals of children. Miss Thelma turned her chin to the sound. She smiled.
That's what keeps me from being forgot.
She closed her eyes, allowing my mother to work on them. She drew a breath and eased lower into the bed. But I didn't hold my family together, I blurted out. My mother raised a finger to her lips for silence. A note. To my Charlie on his wedding day. I know you think these notes are silly. I have watched you scrunch your face over the years when I give them to you. But understand that sometimes I want to tell you something, and I want to get it just right. Putting it down on paper helps me do that. I wish I had been a better writer. I wish I had gone to college. If I had, I think I would have studied English, and maybe my vocabulary would have improved. So many times I feel I am using the same words over and over, like a woman wearing the same dress every day. So boring. What I want to say to you, Charlie, is you are marrying a wonderful girl. I think of Catherine in many ways like I think of Roberta, like a daughter. She's sweet and patient. You should be the same with her, Charlie. Here's what you're going to find out about marriage. You have to work at it together, and you have to love three things. You have to love, one, each other, two, your children, when you have some, hint, hint, three, your marriage. What I mean by that last one is, there may be times that you fight, and sometimes you and Catherine won't even like each other. But those are the times you have to love your marriage. It's like a third party. Look at your wedding photos. Look at any memories you've made. And if you believe in those memories, they will pull you back together. I'm very proud of you today, Charlie. I'm putting this in your tuxedo pocket because I know how you lose things. I love you every day. Mom. From Chick Bonetto's papers, circa 1974.